How's this for an epic set of tunes? Beds Are Burning, Blue Sky Mine, The Power and the Passion. Those are just a few of the songs that Jim McGinney co-wrote for Midnight Oil. He was a founding member of the band. He's a songwriter, guitarist and keyboardist. But beyond that big stage life with the Oils, he was holding a mystery close to his heart for a very long time. Where did he really come from? His new memoir is called The Silver River, a memoir of family lost, made and found. Jim McGinney, welcome to Life Matters.
Ah, Hilary, nice to hear you.
Great to have you with us. Tell us a little bit about where you grew up, because I love the description of your dad's beautiful, perfect lawn in, you know, pure suburbia and the incinerator out the back. What was it like there?
Well, it was up in Wurrunga, which is up near Hornsby, and in those days it was all orchards and a few houses were being built, but it was pretty, you know, rural really in those days. It isn't anymore. And we grew up on a street called Burns Road, which was a big, fast road where people would speed down. And, yeah, the lawn was perfect. He used a roller. He used superphosphate on it, which was the wonder sort of chemical of the era in the 60s. And he if anyone touched his lawn, mate, you're in trouble. You're gone.
Yep. I know that feeling. And it sounds like many of us, you were raised on Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass. Was there much musical variety at home?
Yeah, there was a lot, actually. My parents loved jazz, so Louis Armstrong, of course, and Artie Shaw, they loved him, the clarinetist, which was great. They went to see him at the Trocadero when he played in Sydney. Yeah. And Herb, I think, played at White City, where the Beatles actually played a bit later on. Yeah, Herb was big on the turntable, I tell you what. A bit of Hawaiian stuff too, but mainly, like jazz, big band jazz was their thing, really.
Yeah, the turntable in the bamboo tiki bar, that's a beautiful little detail. Tell us though, Jim, about the moment that this bombshell was dropped on you on a family holiday in Tassie when you were 11.
Well, I was going along pretty well. I was about 11 and we took the Falcon 500 on the Empress of Australia down to Tasmania for a driving holiday, as you used to do. And we were coming back and I was just playing with the water fountain on the boat, just having a bit of fun with that and the cups, little paper cups. And Mum just came up to me from the side and said, "You're adopted." And I was like, "I have to tell you something, you're adopted." And I was like, "Oh, are you okay?" "Yeah, I'm okay." And that was it. That was the only discussion that we had. I don't blame her for that at all, because I don't think she really knew how to kind of put it into words either. So then for the next few years, people never used to talk about this stuff, of course, in the 60s, feelings, you know, feelings after the war, you know, no one could talk about their feelings about being a soldier. You know, you were told to sort of shut up, get on with it. So that was the code of those days, really. But it was a big moment, and I took a long time to sort of I wasn't too sure what had hit me. No, exactly. It was a bomb.
Well, yeah, and you write that, you know, by your early teens you were really retreating into the world of music. It became this haven for you. How much of that do you reckon was about just going, I don't know what's going on here?
Oh, I think it was completely all about that. I mean, music was a refuge because, I mean, adopted people, you know, when they're, you know, if you're a baby in the womb, I'm going to go into a bit of psychobabble here. I hope you don't mind.
But when
you're a baby in the womb, there's expectations. You know, when your lungs are forming, when you're born, they expect to have air. When you're born, it's this mammalian expectation to sort of be breastfed. But of course, what happens when you're adopted? You're born and then you're just given to someone that's feeding you from a bottle. It's a different kind of thing. So your blood, Your brain, as it's forming, floods with cortisol, which is like a fear drug. And so for the rest of your life, because your brain chemistry is altered by it, you know, as it's forming by this drug. And so you're have a different kind of life. You kind of feel like you're not good enough, or you want to run, or you're a stranger. You know, it's this funny thing of being on the outside. You know, nature, it's not as nature intended. So you kind of course, it's all in the emotional unconscious. You don't remember being born. There's nothing, you know, hey, you know, like there I was on May the 18th, 1956 in the hospital in Paddington, where all the unmarried mothers went to have their babies, you know, because marriage then, you know, was the key to everything. If you did, if you had a baby outside of marriage, no one, it just, you can't.
Mm.
You're gone, you know. And of course, my family for Catholic people from the country around Queanbeyan. So they, you know, the local doctor and the local priest were like, you know, just you can't even talk about it. Of course, there was an industry dedicated to babies being born at that time, you know.
Yeah, yeah, it was much harder to keep a baby than to allow it to be given up for adoption.
Yeah, exactly.
We're speaking with Jim McGinney, who is a founding member of Midnight Oil and was having this, you know, huge life on stage, travelling all around the world, touring, massive shows, albums selling like hotcakes. Eventually, obviously, Jim, it started off small and, you know, recruiting Peter Garrett, I understand, was a pretty interesting moment. Perhaps you should tell the listeners about that moment when Peter Garrett first walked into an audition.
Pete's not listening. Hey, Pete. he probably is. He's a big Radio National fan. Yeah, we had a guy came to sing with us, but he stopped turning up. This guy was like Black Sabbath kind of guy. And we got on with writing songs and making our own music. And one day we had an audition because we booked a tour up and down the South Coast. We booked it ourselves, put the posters up, hired the halls and all of that. And Pete turned up for the audition, the only one actually that turned up. And when he arrived, he was monstrously tall with long hair in those days, like Johnny Winter, like that, with a huge, you know, deep eyebrow. He's kind of looking at us like, who are these guys? You know, we were 3 years younger than him. And he'd already left school and had a bit of a life. We were just sort of North Shore schmucks, really. I think he saw us like, who are these guys? But he liked what he heard, you know. And we didn't really have any choice but to hire him, really. He was the only guy that turned up. And he had his own PA system. And I think Rob and I.
Gold.
Yeah, I mean, that was a big thing in those days, have a PA. Oh, my God.
Yep.
And he was in. And we were like, well, yeah, that's good. Yeah, we don't know. Yeah, we'll see how it goes. Mm. And then that was the beginning of all of it, really.
Well, yes. And there was, you know, a lot of slog on the way. But when you did eventually hit the big time, you write a few points in the book, Jim, that, you know, everything on the surface seems great. But at home, things weren't so great. You know, the touring was taking a toll on your family life. And also you just were starting to feel a bit surreal and disconnected from things. What was happening for you then?
Well, you know, I think this is part of the book is trying to unpack that. I think really I think you're just there and you have this desire to run, which I think is a deep down emotional response that adopted people have to things. And I don't want to paint myself as a victim because I'm not. I mean, I don't think that's what it's about. I think it's more, it's deeply in your nervous system. So I found a lot of it really difficult. I don't think the others did. I think they were fine. I kind of had a lot of trouble with people staring at me or, you know, huge amounts of applause or, you know, running off to the dressing room and discovering, you know, that there was someone handing me a glass of whiskey. I mean, that was a big moment because it's a coping mechanism to deal with an anesthetic, to deal with something that's deep down. I didn't understand what was causing that. But I think, you know, with adopted people, it's like, you know, look, your parents didn't want you, but they had their reasons. That's fine. But your adopted ones did. And life actually wants you. You know, this is the whole thing about anybody on the face of the earth. So, I mean, I didn't want to make a story out of all of the pain I was going through, but it was part of accepting myself and wanting myself that I kind of that's the adult part of you that kicks in.
Well,
the thing that's kicked in now, and I have so much gratitude for what the band did for me, and gratitude for the adopted family, and gratitude for my surrendering parents. But that is an adult perspective, and at the time, I certainly didn't have that.
Well, I think, you know, all of what you've been talking about, but the pain as well, will resonate with people who've been through something similar. I was really fascinated too that you were so clear about what changed for you. You know, you're saying there'd been these big transitions in the band and in your marriage, things coming to an end there, and also your adoptive father dying that kind of freed you up to start looking for your birth parents. Tell us a bit about that process, what it was like for you just practically and emotionally, Jim, trying to find them.
Well, it's funny because they say that when one of your parents die, your adoptive parents, then that almost gives you permission to sort of go searching because you don't want to rock the boat, do you? Like they're your parents. They don't want to be threatened by a bunch of other parents and kind of redrawing the the family tree in the shape of a triangle. You know, it's like they didn't want, you know, you don't want to do that to them because they loved you. And of course they did, and you love them. You're not lacking in love, but you're lacking in knowledge about, well, medical stuff for a start. You know, what are the genetic predispositions of my DNA? Do I have, am I, you know, is prostate going to be a problem? Is sort of all these sort of medical things, for example. So it was a, I slowly made progress. I wrote off to the Department of Community Services. I got my birth records, which said that I was 12 hours in labour, my mother's temperature, you know, ovulation, all these sort of quite impersonal documents, and written across the top was for adoption. For adoption was written, stamped actually on the top. So it was funny reading that, and then I slowly found people as I went, and that became a bit of a search. And I, the only, because women changed their names, it was a lot easier to find my father. His name was on, wasn't on the birth certificate, but he married a Susan McRedmond. And so when I went to the records for marriage, I found my father's name, Brian McRedmond, and I looked him up. Wrote him a letter. It didn't, for 5 years, it didn't come. And then he moved and I found him again on the electoral rolls. And he did call me that night. He said, you know, what's this all about? And I said, I vaguely, which is what they say, you know, I knew my mother. I knew Susan McRedmond in 1956 in Sydney. I was wondering whether you could put us in touch. Because I knew they were both alive. That's the other thing I found there. There was no death certificates for them. And he said, well, you're sitting down.
Oh, dear.
And gave me the whole thing that I had 5 full-blooded brothers and sisters and they had 11 children between them. And I was indeed his son. And so I went off to meet him, but he kind of hung up and said, don't call me, I'll call you. You know, I tried to go and see him, but I couldn't. So that was another time of kind of, oh God, he doesn't, you know, God, this guy doesn't want to know about me, of course. And which was all, I was trying to, I was sort of understanding where that voice was coming from by then, that it was the lack of self-worth in a sense of sort of, oh God, this guy doesn't want to know about me either, really. But it was funny. And I did end up meeting him and he was a lovely bloke. He was sort of a lad, you know, he liked to drink and a smoke and a chat and he was a gold prospector and he was a businessman and had a childcare centre and he totally loved doing different things. He didn't stick to one thing at all. I think he would have suited the life of a musician, actually.
That's really interesting, isn't it?
A rock and roller without the rock and roll, you know.
I love, too, the little hints throughout the book that people have said to you, I think you're Irish. I think your roots are Irish. I think maybe you should look in Ireland. That was pretty interesting.
I know. There's something about it. I think the blarney, they could tell the blarney was in deep within me. You know?
Yep. We're speaking with Jim McGinney from Midnight Oil, and his book is called The Silver River, a memoir of family lost, made and found. Your father since passed away, Jim, but tell us about meeting your mum for the first time. The photo in the book is so incredible. You've captioned it, you know, she's examining you forensically. What was it like for you?
Well, it was like I knew her. You know, I was 45 years old and I had some sort of memory of her. This is the weird thing about it. I kind of knew her voice. It's like, you know, in some cultures they sing a special song for babies when they're in the uterus and sing it when they're born and the babies know the song, you know, when they're born. This is part of the whole thing of the strength of the relationship in the womb, you know, that you have. It's an emotional and physical relationship. So when I met her, I had some sort of memory of her voice. I kind of knew. So that hug that I had with her was, you know, it wasn't a normal hug. It was completely profound and sort of primal in a way. It was, there she was, my mother, the person that gave me life. And it was an amazing moment. Yeah, you can see in the photo. I mean, I'm happy as a lark because I'm like, great, I've reunited with my mother. And then everyone else is like scattered, like, what's going on? Who is this guy? Like, oh my God, you know. But they came to terms with it, but I did. I must admit, I sort of danced into their lives quite gaily and merrily. And their reaction was like, oh, my God, this is just unbelievable. Because no, she hadn't told a soul. My father knew. and maybe her sister knew, but that was it. And they didn't breathe a word to anybody because it was shame. It was a shame job in the 50s. You know, you just couldn't even talk about these things. And there's nothing like 50s shame and scandal, is there?
Exactly. Yep, it lasts a long time. Jim, thanks so much for telling us a bit about your story. There's so much more in the book. And people are texting in saying, look, this is very powerful. And other people saying, look, you know, lots of different stories around adoption. The experience is different for different people.
Absolutely.
It's really wonderful to hear about the lovely aspects of yours. Thanks for your time.
That's all right. Thank you so much, Hilary.
It's a pleasure. Musician and author Jim McGinney from Midnight Oil. The memoir's called The Silver River.
It's easier than ever to hear your favourite local and national ABC radio stations live and on demand on the ABC Listen app.